Читайте.
Читайте.
Ничего не говорите.
Говорите.
Ничего.
Ничего не печатайте.
Any horses for foreign countries, huge lots of them?
At the end of the war, I sold all of the horses that were in this country belonging to the British, the French, and the Italian government.
That song, horses, horses, horses?
To what degree do you think the horse is being replaced by the auto?
Well, I have said several times that years ago, a horse used to be afraid of an automobile, but after a while, it'll be so if a horse meets another horse, you'll shy away from him. They'll be so scared.
Thank you, Mr. Evans.
You don't know what he is.
Thank you very much. I think you've given us a very clear picture. Now I want to ask Mr. Fitzgerald, William Fitzgerald, who handles the fur auctions. In the fur auctions...
How does an Irishman come to sell furs? That's what I want
to know. How does an Irishman come to sell furs?
I wouldn't dare make it public.
In the fur actions, where do the furs come from? Where do you get them?
Well, we get them from all parts of the world.
And they're on consignment?
They're sent to us on a consignment basis.
And then how are the furs handled? Are they tagged or put in lots?
They're graded and put into various lots and given a lot number. And thus cataloged.
When the auction gets underway, you're down here in your fur auction, how is the bidding carried on? How do they make the bids?
Well, it's very secretive. One buyer doesn't wish another buyer to know when he's bidding, so he either blinks his eye or wiggles his ear or lifts his finger.
And you have to know all those individual signals for each buyer.
Oh, yes.
I think that's pretty general in our discussions this evening about those secretive bids among the auctioneers that are here, at least from what we said. How often are your fur auctions held?
Well, we hold 4 general sales a year and 5 special silver fox and mink sales during the year.
And that applies to the whole trade?
That applies to the whole trade.
And supplies my lady with everything that she wears in the fur line?
My lady controls the fur line.
She does?
Absolutely.
Well, what is she choosing this year as being very popular?
Well, she still thinks silver fox is very good.
How about red
fox? She's also kind of taking a liking to red fox and mink and beaver. And she's also very fond of muskrats, as she always has been.
I see. How many lots are sold on the average in an hour in your fur auction?
Well, our auctions depend a lot on speed, so we try to sell from 180 to 200 lots an hour.
About yourself now a minute. On what basis is the fur auctioneer paid? Do you have a salary or do you...
Well, we work on... The fur auctioneer works on a salary.
On a salary. Roughly, what is that salary, roughly?
Well, the fur auctioneer earns from $5,000 to $10,000 a year.
Oh, that's a very good salary. Have you ever sold any furs to...
I think the real estate business have to take hold of that fur business and show them how to make money.
Why, do you make more in real estate?
I
get around to you in a minute. Have you ever sold any furs to celebrities?
Well, several years ago, our firm sold silver foxes that were made into capes for the now Duchess of Windsor.
Really? That's very interesting. That goes back into our public history, I guess.
Well, not too far back.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fitzgerald, and for your story of the fur auction and the fur auctioneer. I want to jump over now to the egg auction. I'm jumping over there enough. I've broken about a dozen crates of the egg. Mr. Robert M. Zadra, the auctioneer for the New York Egg Auction Company. Will you tell us, Mr. Zadra, when are the egg auctions held?
Well, we hold our egg auction daily, Monday to Friday inclusive, and we...
In the morning?
At 12:15 every day.
I see. And how long does it run each session?
Well, depending on the volume offered, the average is about an hour and 15 minutes.
Well, just about how many eggs are sold there every day?
Well, on an average of about 1,800 to 2,000 cases daily.
At 30 dozens?
That's 30 dozens to the case, 360 eggs to the case. All fresh eggs, Mr. Day.
It's about 700,000 eggs.
That's right.
That'd make quite an omelet, Mr.
Yes,
Zadra.
Sure would.
Now, how do you get your bids in the egg auction?
Well, the bids, a lot of them are trick signals. A lot of the customer don't care to let the other one know when they do the bidding. Very often, we apply a number to the customer. And instead of mentioning the customer's name at the time of the purchase, why, we mention his number.
And only you know the number.
And only the firm or the clerk that takes the number down knows who the customer is that does the buying due to the fact that his bidding is secretive.
Well, we've heard all about these trick signals of touching the necktie or winking the eye. Is there anything special down there that you have in
your... Well, we have one particular customer that goes into the candling booth, which is covered by curtains, and every time he cares to make a bid, he just sticks his head out of a candling booth, and that's the sign that he's bidding.
Well, that's quite a picture. I want to ask you, too, you mentioned something about telephone bids when we were speaking before the program. What's that all about? What are telephone
bids? Well, we have out-of-town customers. Well, they cannot attend the auction, so naturally, we have several salesmen on a stand which telephones, and these customers will call in, ask the salesman the way the biddings is going in certain lot or brand which they might be interested, and they authorize the salesman to represent them in the bidding, and very often they buy large quantities of eggs in that manner.
They keep in constant touch with the auction, then, I take it?
Yes, they do. They receive a catalog of our offerings every morning in their mail.
Well, how is the egg market at present time? How's that going?
Well, at the very present time, the market is very dull.
It is?
Yes.
I don't quite understand that. I can't see how people would stop eating eggs one day and eat them again the next
day. Well, the price factor is predominant as far as the public. I mean, when eggs go up to 51, 53 cents a dozen for the best eggs, why, people will stop eating eggs and probably go to pork and beans or something like that.
And then the price comes back down again.
That's right.
They're not buying.
That's right.
I suppose that the buyers there at your egg auction represent the tastes of your community around, don't they, and their localities?
Yes.
And you get an idea of what the people like.
That's
they like
right.
Brown eggs or white eggs?
Well, there's not much difference in the quality of brown eggs or white eggs. Here in New York, of course, is largely a white egg market. In other words, the white egg would bring more money here in New York than the brown egg, whereas in Boston, it's just the opposite. They prefer to have the brown eggs up there rather than the whites. But there's no difference in quality.
Same way in Philadelphia. Philadelphia's a brown egg.
That's so.
And now about your income. I don't want to get personal here, but roughly, what does the egg auctioneer average in a year?
You mean as far as salary?
Yes.
Well,
Then you work on commissions?
No. We work on straight salary.
You do work
on straight salary. And, of course, I don't really like to say what I'm being paid because my...
It's a baby.
Employer might be listening in and he may be thinking that I'm not getting enough.
Well, I'm going to ask you a very personal question here, Mr. Zadriff. You sell all these eggs, but do you eat them?
I'm very, very sorry to say that the only time I eat eggs is on a Sunday morning. And that's due to the fact that I've got to get up too early to get to work in time. And I have to commute. Naturally, I haven't got the time to eat the eggs. But I do have them every Sunday, and I do love them.
How many do you eat on a Sunday morning?
Oh, about four.
About four? Well, that's very good. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Zadra. And I hope we didn't go too far behind the scenes into your private life. But I think you did present a very clear picture.
Thank you, Mr. King.
Of the egg situation and the egg auctions. Now we come to Mr. Hiram H. Park, the president of the Park Burnett Galleries, the auctioneers of artistic and literary property. Mr. Park, how long have you been in the business?
42 years.
42 years. You've probably seen a great deal of changes. How did you happen to get into auctioneering of artistic properties?
Well, I first went into the auction business as a clerk. And shortly after, probably 6 or 8 months after going in as a clerk, I was called upon by my employer to relieve him on the stand. He was the auctioneer at that time, and his throat had some affection of his throat at the time, and he asked me to relieve him, and from then on, I've been an auctioneer.
I see. The main personal...
I'll say he's a swell one.
Well, Mr. Day, I know you're a mutual admiration society here, Mr. Park, as you said yourself a little while ago, and I know you're going to help me with the interview here. You just stay right with us, will you? Because I'm going to miss a few questions, I'm sure.
The
main personal requisite in your work is, of course, knowledge of the art goods that you handle, isn't it?
That is true.
That's the first and foremost thing.
First and most important thing.
And what's next? What's the next requisite?
Well, getting the proper goods to sell and getting the buyers for those goods, knowing how to reach the buyers.
A knowledge of personal psychology, in that thing.
That's one of the main essentials of the auction business, the art business especially, art and literary.
Speaking of your business, what famous and outstanding art object have you sold?
Well, I've sold probably some of the most famous sales of art objects that have been sold in this country. In fact, the most outstanding sale was the Great Gary sale back in 1928, which realized over $2,290,000.
What was in that sale? What article?
Well, the highest price picture in that particular sale was the Gainsborough's masterpiece of the harvest wagon, which realized at that sale $360,000.
Hmm. What else was sold there of importance and note?
Also in the same sale, there was a small bust, a marble bust by the great sculptor Houdin.
How much did that bring?
That brought $245,000. That was a bust of his daughter Sabine.
I see. How about your sales of old masters, for instance? You've ever had any outstanding ones there that you can recall?
Yes, we had the great Stillman sale in 1927, in which 37 paintings at that time brought $716,000. And the main picture there and the highest price ever realized for a Rembrandt painting was at that particular sale. And it was the total for the sale was $716,000, of which this one picture brought $270,000.
A Rembrandt. What picture was that?
That was a painting by Rembrandt of his son Titus.
Mm-hmm.
And it realized, I say, $270,000 and sold to the great house of Devine Brothers, Lord Devine, who passed away recently.
I wonder whether you've ever encountered the case of a very small audience resulting in a poor sale or anything of that sort.
Yes, I've had large, very large audiences and very small ones.
Inclemencies of weather, I imagine, affect that.
I recall back in about 1920, on Washington's birthday in 1920, we had a blizzard. And we were selling at that time a collection of Washingtonian material. In other words, objects that were mostly owned by Washington or
his descendants.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the sale was being conducted for one of the Washington family, one of his descendants. And we had this very stormy and snowy day.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't expect to have much of an audience, and Mr. Washington, Lanier Washington, wanted the sale postponed. We told him we thought that we'd have a crowd that day, but there wasn't much of a crowd, but the sale turned out to be very successful.
How was that?
And there were two very good and very liberal bidders at that particular sale. One of them was George D. Smith, one of the great book collectors and book salesmen of his day, and the other was Mr. William Randolph Hearst, and the two of them made that sale for us.
I see.
And it proved to be very successful.
Well, what was the largest audience? Skipping over to the other side, the largest audience that you ever
saw? That was in the Gary sale, which I had the pleasure of conducting at the Hotel Plaza on April 28, 1928. And the ballroom at that time, the seating capacity of the ballroom at that time was 1,800. But there were more than 3,600 people in the ballroom had passed through the doors.
Now, imagine you could hardly get up in the stand.
It was the sale was scheduled for 8:30.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 9 o'clock before I could get to the rostrum.
And it was a big
success. And started the sale. And the sale was a big success. That evening sale run about $1,400,000.
Well, now, I know we're speaking in big terms, and we're speaking of people who buy. Big money terms, I mean, of course. People who buy art objects. Have you ever encountered cases of unlimited counterbidding on the same article?
Yes, I once had an instance in Philadelphia where I was selling a sale for one of the very wealthy families there in Philadelphia. And one of the most prominent citizens at that time was executor for this particular estate. And just on the eve of the sale, he was called to Brussels and had left me an unlimited bid on a pair of pictures. And the sale came off within a few days, and I was selling these particular pictures, and I noticed that they had run up to considerably more than we thought they were valued at. And the only two that seemed to be bidding at that time was myself as auctioneer and one of my assistants. I called to him and asked him I couldn't ask him his bid exactly, but I asked whether he had had some sort of an unlimited bid left with him, and he said that he had had, And I, knowing that I had this unlimited bid from the executor or his representative, I merely stopped the sale of those two pictures, withdrew them from the sale until I could get the two bidders together.
And settle it that way.
And it was settled in that way, and they were divided. One taking the female portrait and the other the male portrait.
I see. Well, thank you very much. You've given us a wonderful story there.
You split a family, didn't you?
Indeed.
Auctioneer of artistic properties, Mr. Parks. Now I'm going to turn around here to Mr. Joseph P. Day, the auctioneer of real estate, who's all set and ready to go. Mr. Day, you've been very quiet. But your fame as an auctioneer runs right along with our other guests this evening, and you're certainly one of the super salesmen of the day. You've never by any chance sold the Brooklyn Bridge, have you?
No, but I sold the 6th Avenue elevators.
Oh, no, wait a minute. Tell us about it. You sold the 6th Avenue elevated?
Yes.
Tell me all about that.
That's a short story. Sold it. After they bought it, they found out that there was cement in the pillars, and so they lost money on it. But that wasn't the fault of the auctioneer or anybody else. Nobody knew about it.
How does selling real estate differ from the methods of these other gentlemen?
Well, it's the principles, I think, are the same in all. It's sort of action. It's first attention, and then desire,
mm-hmm.
and then finally it leads up to getting
the actual sale.
Yes, getting the sale itself.
Well, now, what real estate have you auctioned at the highest price? What big package have you sold? What's your biggest package?
The Henry Astor Estate.
How much did that go for?
$6 million.
Oh, my goodness.
$6 million.
$6 million.
How much... The Commodore Gould Estate went for $6.5 million. And the James Gordon Bennett Estate, the owner of the late New York Herald before it was taken into the Herald Tribune.
Yes.
That was lots up in the Bronx. And that sold up in Washington Heights, and that sold for $1,700,000 in the afternoon, and the biggest buyer was this Dr. Paterno.
You've had many millions of dollars come across the auction block. How much real estate have you sold at auction, do you imagine, in the course of your work as an auctioneer?
About $1 billion worth.
About $1 billion?
Mm-hmm.
Beginning with a B.
Billion. Not million, billion.
Why is real estate often auctioned off instead of being sold off at a set price? I don't understand that.
Why, it's the reason of that is estates where there's heirs and children and scattered heirs, and it's sold then to the order, sold by the highest bidder.
To settle financially the estate.
There's a law in many states that there's no buy bidding.
No.
In New York State, there's no buy bidding permitted.
What do you mean by buy bidding?
Why, there's nobody can go in and
bid it up?
Boost up the sale. No, it's,
must be all.
It must be bona fide.
I suppose.
That's the protection.
I suppose psychology plays a big part in your auctioneering, doesn't it?
It does.
Do you have any reminiscences on that subject of psychology?
Well, now we're talking about this arms restriction.
Yes.
Sal Bloom.
Yes.
I sold him a piece of property one afternoon for $340,000.
You really did? Tell us about that.
Well, he didn't. He thought his bid was only $335,000, and I said, Sal, you've got to take it. It's $340,000. That's what I took your bid at. And he came back to our... He went out a little bit angry, and he came back 2 hours after, and he said, Joe, is that still open for me? I said, it certainly is. And I expect you to take it. Or at least I want to take it. I've just sold the contract for $40,000 profit. I gave him the property at his bid. At the bid I said.
What's your hobby, Mr. Day?
Well, one of my hobbies is buying Gertie's prayer rugs at auction from that young man... Park over there, or the park.
Mr. Park, is he a good judge of values?
Well, I think his judgment's pretty good on those things.
I see. Well, thank you very much. I want to thank you, Mr. Day, and you, Mr. Park. And as they say at an auction sale, all done. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening
to... No, not all done. Sold.
Sold. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Americans at Work, the program about you and what you do for a living, presented each week by the CBS Department of Education. Previous Americans at Work scripts, complete with directional cues, have been printed in attractive pamphlet form. Single copies may be obtained for 10 cents each, or for $1, you may secure a set of 13 different scripts. Just send your order to Americans at Work, CBS, New York. Tonight's program was directed by Brewster Morgan. The Workers' Education Bureau of America collaborates on research for the entire series. Next Thursday evening, Americans at Work will be heard from 10:30 to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. John Reed King speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
...10 p.m. BULOVA, Bulova Watch Time. Here's a distinguished timepiece. The 21-jewel Bulova President in the charm and color of natural gold. Curved, streamlined, an exceptional value. WJSV, Washington.
You can't stop this. You can't stop this. You can't stop this. Just feel the power emanate from me now. I'll light you up again, friend. You can't stop this. You can't stop this. You can't stop this. You can't stop this. Push me, I will go higher. Just get up again. I'm the energy man. You can't stop this. Feel me, I am a fire. Nothing can scare me now. I'll light you up again, friend. You can't stop this. You can't stop me. 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 You can't stop this.
Niets mis met een portie frieten op tijd en stond, maar in tegenstelling tot het nieuwe Vlaamse Opperhoofd mag er toch wel wat variatie in ons menu zitten. Elke dag hetzelfde, dat is ook maar saai. Daarom serveren we ook deze week weer een exquis menu met heel wat verschillende nieuwe lekkernijen. Goedenavond en welkom bij Signaal Ruis. En we gaan hier al direct de experimentele tour op met het New Yorkse gezelschap Open Head. Het kwartet uit Hudson Valley heeft een veelbelovende debuutsingle uit bij Wharfcat Records, waarbij ze instrumenten laten klinken als allerhande materialen. Dit is Catacomb van Open Head. Catacomb van Openhead, een nieuwe band uit New York die al mooie voorprogramma's heeft mogen verzorgen in hun thuisstad. Voor onder andere Bodega, Show Me The Body en Want. Gisteravond was onze avond meteen geslaagd toen we deze gloednieuwe single van Maruja hoorden. Opnieuw een banger van formaat van dit viertal uit Manchester. En we hebben nog meer spijt dat we getreuzeld hebben om tickets te kopen voor hun ondertussen hopeloos uitverkochte show in die veel te kleine witloofbar van de Botaniek. En dat is op 23 oktober. Dit is Break the Tension van Maruja.
Welcome to another deep dive. This one's going to be about art.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's about art and current events. Yeah. It's for people who like both of those things.
Gotcha.
And this is one where we're eavesdropping on a debate between two artists.
Okay.
And it's about an art project that tackles the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Wow.
In a very provocative way.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
So the two artists are named Hero Workman
and
Andreas Maria Jacobs.
Great.
Workman is the artist behind the Kienkampf Gallery.
Yeah.
And he calls himself a working class hero.
Right.
And he reached out to Jacobs with an idea for a project.
Right.
And the idea is a digital art exhibition centered around the phrase New Auschwitz.
Oh, wow. Okay. So right away, we're in a very charged space.
Yeah.
Right? Using New Auschwitz.
Right.
Immediately invokes one of history's like darkest chapters.
Right.
Like just the weight of that term.
Right.
So the question becomes like, what is the intended impact of using that comparison?
Right.
And then also, what are the potential consequences? Because, you know, you can't just throw that phrase around lightly, it seems like.
Yeah. And I mean, Workman in his initial email to Jacobs doesn't mince words.
Okay.
He really like lays it all out there.
Okay.
And he sees the situation in Gaza, especially after the October 7th attacks, as a reflection of the horrors inflicted by the Nazis.
Wow.
The suffering, the global community's response, he sees direct parallels.
Yeah. And this is where, you know, the idea of Holocaust inversion comes in.
Okay.
Which is, you know, a perspective that argues that directly equating Israeli policies with the actions of the Nazis is itself a form of anti-Semitism. Right. This conversation really highlights how sensitive and potentially fraught these comparisons are.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is a really difficult conversation to have.
Yeah.
But it's important, I think, to have these kinds of conversations.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, Jacobs pushes back hard.
Okay.
He's not afraid to disagree.
Okay.
And he doesn't hold back.
Okay.
He pulls you into this whirlwind tour of historical atrocities.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The Rwandan genocide, the Syrian civil war.
Yeah.
And he's building this case that while the situation in Gaza is obviously tragic,
right.
he says that it differs fundamentally from the Holocaust in its scale and systematic nature.
He's drawing a line in the sand, it seems like.
He is.
Yeah.
Now, Workman doubles down.
Okay.
And clarifies that he's not saying the two situations are identical.
Yeah.
He's arguing that using New Auschwitz is about conveying the intensity of the suffering in Gaza.
Okay.
He wants to break through what he sees as the limitations of mainstream media and their narratives.
So this is a critical distinction.
Yeah.
Because it gets to the heart of artistic license and responsibility.
Right.
Right. Can art, even with the best intentions, be a force for change without diminishing or trivializing historical atrocities?
Yeah.
It's a tightrope walk.
It is. And that's kind of where Jacobs lands, is can a title as provocative as that overshadow the message?
Yeah.
And he seems to think it might.
He's skeptical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He is.
And understandably so.
Yeah. And, you know, he questions whether art alone
right.
can make a dent.
Yeah.
These deeply rooted political and economic systems at play in this conflict.
Yeah, he seems to be advocating for a deeper understanding of the root causes, you know, what's going on behind the scenes, rather than just commenting on the suffering.
Right. He wants action, not just commentary.
Exactly.
And to illustrate that point, he suggests that Workman connect with Rob Schrama,
okay.
who's an artist known for his nuanced and informed work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
So he's saying, look, if you're going to tackle this sensitive topic,
yeah.
you need a more nuanced and informed approach.
Right.
This might need a much larger canvas than a single art project.
And this back and forth between them, I think, throws a really tough question at us as the audience.
Yeah.
Can art really be a force for change in the real world?
It's a big question.
Or are we just admiring a message on a canvas while atrocities continue?
Right. Are we just passively observing this?
Right.
It's a powerful image. And it makes you think about that question, like, does anything really change?
Right. Like, are we even capable of changing?
Exactly.
And it's interesting because Workman talks about how focusing on the optics of the conflict, you know, the way it's often framed in the media might actually be perpetuating the cycle of suffering.
Oh, interesting.
He wants to push past the headlines and grapple with that raw human element.
Yeah, like get to the heart of it.
Yeah, and he says it's not about taking sides.
Okay.
It's about recognizing our shared capacity for suffering.
Our shared humanity.
Exactly. And this is where the conversation, I think, takes a fascinating turn.
Okay.
Because Jacobs, while he is skeptical of the New Auschwitz concept,
right.
he seems to agree with Workman on a fundamental level.
On that human element.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. He acknowledges that deep-seated human capacity for inflicting pain.
Yeah.
And the role of media desensitization.
Right, because we see so much suffering in the media all the time.
All the time.
That it's easy to become numb to it.
And he admits that even he would rather focus on his own spiritual evolution than dwell on the horrors of the world.
I mean, haven't we all been there?
Oh, absolutely.
Right. It's so much easier to just turn away.
It's a very human response
yeah.
to want to shield ourselves from pain.
Absolutely.
From that overwhelming weight of the world's suffering.
And so that's, I think, Workman's challenge, and maybe the challenge of art in general.
Okay.
Is to kind of shake us out of that complacency, to make us feel something, even if it's uncomfortable. So that we're moved to act.
Right. And Jacobs, being a bit more pragmatic,
yeah.
sees the limits of this approach.
Okay.
He brings up Picasso's Guernica.
Oh, wow.
That iconic anti-war painting.
Yeah.
Almost as a counterpoint.
It's a brilliant comparison.
Yeah.
Because it makes you think, did Guernica actually stop the violence that it depicts?
Right.
Did it prevent future atrocities?
Right.
Or is it more accurate to say that it serves as a stark reminder.
Okay.
A testament to the horrors of war that we can't afford to ignore.
So are we supposed to just throw our hands up and say, well, art can't change anything, so what's the point?
Right, like why bother?
Yeah.
I think that's where this conversation pushes us beyond a simple answer.
Okay.
It's not about finding solutions within the canvas.
Okay.
Or the sculpture itself.
Okay.
It's about what happens after we encounter the art.
Okay.
Does it spark a conversation? Does it change how we see the world even slightly?
Yeah.
Does it make us think about things we'd rather ignore?
Right.
Those are the questions.
And Workman seems to think that art can do all of that.
Okay.
And he keeps circling back to the idea that it can force self-reflection, mm-hmm. both individually and collectively.
Okay.
He talks about recognizing suffering as a universal problem.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, something inherent to the human experience.
That's powerful because it transcends political boundaries.
Yeah.
Religious differences, all those things that tend to divide us.
Right.
It goes straight to the heart of our shared humanity.
But Jacobs remains unconvinced.
Okay.
Particularly about the effectiveness of this specific art project.
He's still hung up on the new Auschwitz.
It seems like it. Yeah. He sees it as workmen making a statement, shouting about the horrors of the situation,
okay.
rather than offering a tangible way forward.
So he's concerned about the potential for further polarization.
Right.
For deepening the divides that Workman claims he wants to bridge.
But Workman pushes back on that.
Okay.
And he says, look, I'm not trying to offer easy answers here.
Okay.
He's more interested in stirring something within the viewer.
Okay.
Prompting them to grapple with these complex emotions and questions on their own terms.
So leaving it open-ended?
Yes.
Okay.
He wants to leave us with that final lingering question.
Which is?
New Auschwitz, does anything really change or are we unwilling or unable to change it?
It's a question without an easy answer.
For sure.
But it's one we all have to wrestle with, both individually and as a global community.
It's a big one. And what do you think? Can art be a force for change in the real world? You know, it's interesting. What makes this whole thing so fascinating is that they're both willing to, like, ask these hard questions, and they push each other to really think critically about the role of art in a world that's, you know, overflowing with information, with suffering, that often feels too vast to even comprehend.
And what I think is really refreshing is that they're not afraid to disagree.
Totally.
Like, they're not trying to come to this, like, neat little resolution or a single right answer.
Right.
It's like they're modeling this kind of intellectual honesty that you don't really see a lot these days.
It feels very authentic.
Yeah, totally.
And I think you can feel the respect underneath it all, even when they're challenging each other's ideas pretty intensely.
Which I think speaks volumes. It suggests that you can have these conversations about really complex, even contentious topics without, like, resorting to personal attacks or shutting down the conversation.
Right.
Just because you disagree doesn't mean you can't have a conversation.
Right. And so it's like, where does this all leave us?
Yeah.
Workman seems to still really believe in this idea of New Auschwitz as a catalyst for change.
He's committed to the idea.
Yeah.
It seems like.
He's really committed.
Oh.
He sees it as, like, this necessary provocation.
Okay.
A way to jolt people out of their complacency mm-hmm. and force them to confront the brutal realities of this conflict.
Yeah.
And just more broadly, like, the human capacity for inflicting suffering.
He doesn't want us to look away.
He does not.
Okay.
But I keep coming back to Jacobs's point that art alone might not be enough. Like, we need to look deeper, right?
Yeah.
We need to address the political and economic systems that allow these cycles of violence to continue.
That's a really important takeaway, I think, from this whole conversation.
Absolutely.
It's a reminder that while art is powerful,
uh-huh.
you know, in raising awareness and getting us to reflect,
sure,
it's not a magic solution.
Right.
It can't just, like, dismantle these huge power structures or resolve deeply entrenched conflicts overnight.
So it's not an either thing.
Like, exactly.
It's about recognizing how interconnected these different things are and finding ways to work within them to create change.
I think that's a really good point. Like, it's about understanding how art, politics, economics, how they all kind of play into each other.
Yeah, and recognizing we all have a role to play.
Absolutely.
Even if they look different.
And maybe that's a good place to kind of wrap up this conversation.
Yeah, this has been a really thought-provoking deep dive.
Yeah.
And I think it really speaks to the responsibility we all share to engage with the world in a thoughtful, compassionate, and impactful way.
Yeah. And not shy away from the hard questions.
Absolutely.
Even when they make us uncomfortable.
Exactly. And I think that's what's so great about these deep dives is that
we're
left not with easy answers,
right,
but with deeper questions.
Yeah.
And with a desire to kind of, like, go out and learn more and do more.
And that's a powerful place to be.
It is.
Because it's in that space of questioning and seeking that real change, I think, becomes possible.
I totally agree. We are like we don't exist. Mutual condition.
auction the soul, pump for the gold, tell or be told, envy, betray you, revenge got a hold, can't break the tension, brittle like bone, stress like a burden your family behold, eyes to your phone, and scornful in person, feeding to feelings are always misleading, coercion invaded, face to the pavement, ain't no more choices, fuck every statement, fuck waiting patient, hands on the throat, screaming for vengeance, time to
Natalie Song van Font, de afsluiter van hun debuut Strange Burden. Begin november komen ze naar België. Ze speelden dan op het gloednieuwe Lenui Weekender Festival in de Brusselse Botaniek, met onder meer Tramhouse, nog zo'n signaalruis favoriet. Volgende week delen we vrijkaarten uit. De Braziliaans-Amerikaanse zangeres Victoria Winter heeft heel wat slaapproblemen. Ze schreef erover een nummer voor Words from a Wishing Well, de debuutplaat van haar band Shower Curtain. Dat is dit nummer, Benadryl Man van Shower Curtain. We'll be right back.
dobberden even rustig rond in het muzikale wereldje van Reese Woodruff. Variety was oorspronkelijk zijn slaapkamerproject, maar ondertussen heeft hij een paar vrienden opgetrommeld om zijn muziek live te kunnen spelen. En die vrienden die hebben ook meegeknutseld aan het debuut van de band. Dit was daaruit Subtropical en dat is ook de titel van die plaat. Soms komen de beste dingen wel uit onverwachte hoek en in onze stroom met nieuwe muziek waren we toch wel getriggerd door Town of Lake met het nummer Where At. Dit project blijkt een zijproject te zijn van Mike Ranica. En dat zegt jullie waarschijnlijk niets, ons ook niet. Maar dat is de frontman van metalcore zwaargewichten The Devil Wears Prada. Ranica's dreunende noise solo project kon ons toch wel meer bekoren. Dit is Town of Lake met Where At.
Dead trees, Kabbalah freaks, time is now. Black days, salacious breeze, the year was then. Driving through the half glow, every piece of me. Absinthe, my throat full, economically. You could have had it, but you took it anyway. You could have had it, but you took it anyway. Another shot, another ricochet. Could have had it, but you took it anyway. Damp stone. Damp stone. Brick medicine. I can't control it. Wet season, never to dry. I still can't control it. Heading west on 18th. Every piece of me. Absinthe. My throat full. Anatomically. You could have had it, but you took it anyway. You could have had it, but you took it anyway. We're at another ricochet. You could have had it, but you took it anyway.